So it's my pleasure to introduce you to introduce today's panel discussion if you haven't yet read the article on the Teslas written by our moderator and included in the Historical Society's fall magazine, I would definitely encourage you to do so. It's a phenomenal article and all around magazine. A native of Portland, New York, Professor Emerita Diane Becchio's background as the daughter of an Italian immigrant set the course for her future studies in immigration history. Dr. Becchio's graduate research in immigration and manufacturing while a student at Syracuse positions her perfectly as moderator of this morning's panel. Professor Emerita Becchio joined the Department of History at Furman in 1996. In addition to Italian immigration, Professor Becchio's research interests include Southern Jewish history, European women's resistance during World War II, and local history of the South Carolina Upcountry. She's presently working on a book on Jews in Upcountry South Carolina and has previously published dozens of articles on Italian and Jewish immigrants in scholarly journals. Please do join me in welcoming Professor Emerita Diane Becchio, who will introduce our today's topic.
Good morning, everyone. I'm delighted to be here. As most of you know, the upcountry of South Carolina, which includes Spartanburg and Greenville, was known as the textile capital of the South. In fact, at one point, it was even called the textile capital of the world. So it is fitting that we talk about a family that had a huge impact on textile manufacturing in South Carolina. Today, I would like to, if you don't mind, I'm going to read a section from the book that I'm writing on the history of upcountry South Carolina Jews. And it deals with the Teslas. This will provide some historical background to the history of the Tesla family in Hungary, as well as their important role in textile manufacturing in both Spartanburg, South Carolina, and in North Carolina. Following my discussion, we will have a wonderful film that will be introduced by the Vice President Vice President Senior Vice President at Wofford. And then we will open up an informal discussion and we'll have being led by one of the speakers that is here today. One of the other speakers could not make it today, so we apologize for that, but it will be, I think, a very lively discussion. So let me talk a little bit about the background and the history of the Teslas in South Carolina. The history of the Tesla family is deeply intertwined with the tumultuous political movements that swallowed Hungary during the first half of the 20th century. Sándor Tesler was born in 1903 to Jewish parents in Budapest. Tesler, his wife Lydia, and their sons Andrew and Otto survived the brutality of the Holocaust and the communist takeover of Hungary that followed. Fleeing their homeland first to England and then to the United States in 1948, the Teslas found a refuge and renewed purpose in the textile industry that so powerfully shaped upstate South Carolina. Confined to a Catholic hospital for much of his young life, undergoing multiple surgeries for club feet made it impossible for young Sándor to attend school, but his education was provided by, quote, the good nuns who were teaching me. When he was finally able to walk, the nuns took him to public school for testing and grade placement. Intelligent and astute, Tesler had no trouble completing primary school. He then entered a commercial business high school in Budapest, relieved that he had not been shamed by his peers because of his disability. Following graduation, Tesler studied textile engineering at a university in Chemnitz, Germany. He graduated in 1925 and returned to Budapest to work in a knitting factory. Hungary was still reeling from the political and economic turmoil brought about by World War I. But in the midst of a volatile and unstable political atmosphere, he and his brother Joseph, who was also in the textile business, opened a hosiery and underwear factory in Yugoslavia. Joseph and Sandor were so successful that they were invited to merge with another prominent knitting factory in Croatia, which they did in 1929. In the late 1930s, Tesler's successes were overshadowed by the growing menace of Nazism. After Hitler was appointed Chancellor of Germany in 1933, the head of the Hungarian state embraced the authoritarian nationalist ideology espoused by the Nazi Party. On May 29, 1938, anti-Jewish legislation was established in Hungary. Lydia Tesler, Sandor's wife, cut out yellow stars and sewed them onto her family's clothing. Sandor mentioned in his memoir, quote, "That was the greatest tragedy in our lives, being distinguished as different from other Hungarians," end quote. The Tesler brothers went about their business and opened a new plant in Belgrade in January 1941, in the midst of a worsening political situation. Danger loomed when the Germans occupied the city in April 1941. Still, the factory continued to operate, and the Teslers lived relatively free from persecution. The two brothers operated factories in several Central European countries, and Sandor admitted that, quote, "We lived in a dream world, never believing that deportation could happen to us," end quote. Yet all around them, atrocities were occurring. Following the German invasion of Poland and the outbreak of World War II, the ruthless Nazi takeover of Europe continued, and on April 6, 1941, Germany declared war on Yugoslavia. The district where Tesler's factory was located came under state control, but continued to produce textile goods for the Hungarians. For 3 years, the Tesler family remained unharmed as Hungarian regent Horthy and Prime Minister Miklos Kalay ignored a repeated request from Hitler and other German officials to deport Jews from Hungary to concentration camps. When the German army occupied Hungary in 1944, the situation for Hungary's Jews deteriorated. Quote, the German invasion came and our tragedy started, lamented Tesler. Facing death at the hands of Nazis, the Tesler family doctor supplied each of them with cyanide tablets to wear on a string around their neck in case they were deported to a death camp. Amazingly, Sandor and his family were given a temporary reprieve. He was allowed to return to his factory, where he continued operating the plant under the watchful eye of a German officer. Eventually, however, the family's luck ran out. The Teslers, along with hundreds of other Jews, were rounded up and detained at a synagogue awaiting deportation. Fortunately, the textile factory could not operate without Tesler's supervision. A Hungarian employee informed the SS officer that there was no one else capable of running the factory and that they needed to get Tesler back. Tesler and his family were given a stay of 6 months so that Sandor could run the factory. On September 26, 1944, after the six-month reprieve, the police removed the Teslers to Budapest, relocated them, along with hundreds of other Jews, to Yellow Star houses. The terror against the Jews had begun. The Nazis rounded up Jews living in the Yellow Star houses, which Tesler referred to as Jew houses. In desperation, the Teslers contemplated taking the cyanide pills before being deported. Miraculously, Sandor and Lydia were saved by Karl Lutz, a member of the Swiss Council, who is credited with saving thousands of Hungarian Jews. Lutz, the Vice Consul of the Swiss Embassy's Department of Foreign Interest, issued thousands of protective documents to Hungarian Jews, granting them Swiss diplomatic immunity. On February 15, 1945, the Soviets liberated Budapest and the remaining Jewish prisoners. But it was too late for Sandor's father, brother, sister-in-law, nieces, and nephews, as well as mother-in-law and father-in-law. They had all perished in the Holocaust. After they were liberated by the Soviets, Sandor and Lydia tried to cope as best they could with the horrors and losses they endured during the war. Sandor tried to rebuild his business, but the communist-controlled Yugoslav government seized their factory, claiming they had collaborated with the Germans during the war. As the communist takeover seized Hungary, Sandor and Lydia fled to Great Britain to join their two sons who had been sent there earlier. In 1946, President Harry Truman proposed a bill to Congress admitting Jews to the United States outside of the quota system. This slight relaxation in the number of Jews who could enter the United States after World War II ultimately aided the Teslers' entry into the United States. In January 1948, Sandor and Lydia left England and emigrated to the United States. They settled in New York City, where another Tesler brother, Akos, a textile chemist who immigrated in 1927, had established a small factory on Long Island. When Sandor arrived, Akos made him a partner in his textile business. And in 1952, after Joseph's death, Sandor took over the company. Andrew and Otto, their sons, soon joined their parents in the United States and both enrolled in the textile engineering program at North Carolina State University, which was recognized as a world leader in textile education and research. After graduation, Andrew got a job at a knitting factory in Delaware, and Otto was recruited to work for the American Aviation Company in California. In 1959, David Schwartz, the president and chairman of the board of Jonathan Logan in New York City. Some women may remember Jonathan Logan because in the 1960s, they were a leading manufacturer of double knit clothing for women. So David Schwartz listened attentively to an idea from Andrew Tesler, a young unknown graduate of North Carolina State University. Double knit garments were already popular in Europe, and the young Tesler had the idea to start the first double knit operation in the United States. Schwartz liked Tesler's idea. After a feasibility study, the two men agreed on a unique plan for the new business: a vertically integrated manufacturing facility producing a double knit garment from raw fiber. After the fiber had been spun, dyed, and knit, the finished fabric would be cut and sewed into high quality, popular priced garments. After purchasing textile machinery in Europe, Schwartz sent Andrew to Spartanburg to organize the Butte Knit Division for parent company Jonathan Logan. The city's rich textile heritage had earned Spartanburg the distinction of the Lowell of the South in the early decades of the 20th century. With decades of vast cotton production, established textile manufacturing, supplier industries, and massive tax breaks provided by the state of South Carolina, Spartanburg was a logical site for the new enterprise. It opened in 1960 and eventually became one of the most outstanding operations in the entire textile garment industry, producing double knit dresses and ensembles for women. Andrew Tesler recruited upper level managers and specialists for his factory through familial and social networking, a strategy commonly employed by Jews and other immigrants. The men he recruited to Spartanburg eventually became members of the Jewish community and Temple Beni Israel. Many of the newly hired executives were New York City transplants, while others had worked in a variety of southern industries. Tesler hired Sam Witz, a specialist in distribution, from parent company Jonathan Logan. Marvin Siegel was hired as an accountant and later made vice president of finance. Barry Goldman, Siegel's brother-in-law, was brought on as a management trainee. Tesler hired Julius Bloom of New York as a vice president in the early years of the company and appointed Richard Alcanfora controller. Tesler employed Jack Tobin, an expert pattern designer who had been working with another southern firm, and he also hired Lou Geller and David Adelman. Adelman had previously worked as an executive at Spartan Undies, another Jewish-run firm in Spartanburg. And Seymour Greenwald was hired as a sales manager. Some of the transplanted northerners, such as Alcanfora, Siegel, Witz, and Tobin, became presidents and board members of Temple B'nai Israel. The connections between Andrew Tesler and the people he hired at Butnit ran deep. Many of them were Holocaust survivors like himself. Joseph Rex, whose wife, Sylvia, is in the audience this morning, was hired as a director of public relations, was also born in Budapest, grew up in Yugoslavia, and joined the Yugoslavian partisan movement resisting the Nazis. Lajos Bruck was a Hungarian Jewish refugee who had worked as a salesman for a textile company in Hungary, and Tesler hired him as a salesman for Butte. Andrew Ehrenstein had been a member of the Hungarian resistance movement. He and his wife Magda and son Gabriel were living in Israel when David Schwartz of Jonathan Logan hired Ehrenstein and brought the family to the United States. These former resistance fighters and Jewish refugees found a patron in Andrew Tesler, who provided them with a job and security and a growing company. His experience as a victim of anti-Semitism in Hitler's Europe informed his life and actions in America. His commitment and compassion for other Hungarian Holocaust survivors reveals a strong emotional tie to his Jewish countrymen with whom he shared so much. Coming together in a small city and a tightly knit religious community solidified the survivors and their families with enduring friendships and support from their temple community. Lonely and longing to be with their sons, Sandor and Lydia sold the textile plant on Long Island and moved to Spartanburg in 1961. 1 year later, Sandor launched Shannon Knit, a textile mill located in Kings Mountain, North Carolina. A small town near Charlotte, made famous by the Revolutionary War Band of Kings Mountain. The senior Tesler was deeply troubled by the racial segregation that dictated life in the South. The Carolinas, of course, like the rest of the South in the early 60s, strictly enforced Jim Crow segregation. Public schools, facilities, and churches were all segregated. A Jew would experience the humiliation of segregation in Europe and was forced to wear a yellow star following the Nazi occupation, Sandro Tesler could not abide by these racist practices. Shortly before opening his plant, the mayor of Kings Mountain visited him and said, quote, "Hopefully you will only have white people working for you." A local black minister also stopped to see Sandor and said, quote, "I hope you will hire black people." Sandor responded, "Reverend, I belong to the minority in Europe, and you can't tell me about being a minority. When the time comes, I will call you, and you will recommend to me black high school graduates, boys and girls, and I will hire them." Tesler hired both black and white workers at Shannon Knit. In his factory, there were no segregated bathrooms, water fountains, or dining areas. Even before the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Tesler boasted, quote, "My plant was fully integrated, with 30% of my workers being black. I was probably the first man in the history of North Carolina who integrated a plant," end quote. Tesler made the hour commute from Spartanburg to Kings Mountain until 1965, when he decided to sell the plant. He was thoroughly enjoying life in Spartanburg, enhanced by close proximity to his son, Andrew, Andrew's wife, Jane, and their two children. Sandor was involved in community events, and he, as well as his son and daughter-in-law, became active members in this temple. As soon as Sandor sold Shannon Knit, Andrew asked his father to join him at Butte Mill to reorganize quality control at the factory. Soon, father and son were working together in Spartanburg. The meteoric rise of Andrew's company, Butte Knitting Mill in Spartanburg, was phenomenal. From 1960 to 1976, Butte expanded 24 times, building 2.2 million square feet of factory space in the Spartanburg area and adding several divisions, one called Lana Knit at Shannon Free Airport in Ireland. At the same time, Butte built or acquired 26 sewing factories in the United States. Andrew Tesler was known as a brilliant technician with keen organization skills and an uncanny ability to motivate people. On January 1st, 1969, Butte's closest associate, Jonathan Logan, Act 3, the knitted sportswear operation, became officially integrated with Butte Knitting Mill in Spartanburg. By the mid-1960s, it had become the largest employer in Spartanburg County, with over 3,000 workers. In 1966, a year after Sandor joined Butte, David Schwartz of Jonathan Logan and his son, Andrew, asked Sandor to go to the United Kingdom to improve the operation of their facilities in London and Shannon. Sandor's son, Otto, joined him, and together they reorganized and modernized both facilities, which, according to Sandor, quote, were below my standards. Sandor returned to Spartanburg in 1967 and resumed working with Andrew at Butte in production and quality control. In 1970, Andrew made a bold move and left Butte Knitting Mill and broke from Jonathan Logan to establish his own vertically integrated knitting plant. In June 1970, he opened Olympia Mills in Spartanburg and another plant in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Sandor and Andrew worked together at Olympia Mills, where they produced polyester fabrics and employed 900 workers. Sandor ran the Olympic plant until early 1971, when Otto returned from Shannon, Ireland, and joined his father and brother in the business. In May 1971, at the peak of his career, Andrew Tesler died of a massive heart attack. He was only 40 years old and left behind a bereft wife and three children. His mother and father were heartbroken. Following his death, former employees recalled Andrew Tesler's many acts of kindness, such as the time he gave a worker the coat off his back after the man said he admired it. When the five-year-old son of an employee was being treated for leukemia, Tesler organized a blood drive for the boy and flew him and his parents to St. Jude's Hospital in Memphis on his private jet. One employee recalled that Tesler gave him $1,000 when his house was destroyed by fire, and another recollected that he paid for his son's college education. Before his death, Andrew Tesler was named Man of the Year by Phi Psi, North Carolina State University's School of Textile Fraternity, and awarded an honorary degree. The Man of the Year Award recognized Tesler for his contributions to the advancement of the textile industry, as well as his contributions to Spartanburg. His gifts to the community were enormous. A devoted civic leader, Tesler's generosity brought benefits to the entire Spartanburg community that endured to the present day. He purchased the first intensive care heart unit and the first heart scanner for Spartanburg, what was then Spartanburg General Hospital. His donations made possible the construction of an education building at Temple B'nai Israel, and he spearheaded a campaign to raise $950,000 to open the Charles Lee Center for the Education of Handicapped Children. In 1969, Andrew became a member of the Board of Trustees at Wofford College and donated money for the building of a new library on the campus, honoring his father, and named it the Sandor Tesler Library. Additionally, Tesler was a Wofford College trustee and served on the Governor's Commission on Human Relations. After Andrew's sudden death, Sandor became a chairman of Olympic Mills. In 1974, Monsanto bought Olympia just as the double net business went into a steep decline and turned it into the world's largest silicon wafer plant in 1979. In that same year, Sandor Tesler stepped down as chairman and commenced his retirement. Sandor's son, Otto, left Spartanburg after his brother's death and eventually took a job in Jonesville, South Carolina, with Wellman Industries. Otto and John Wellman had a revolutionary idea for the production of a new type of yarn made from waste, and together they opened a small plant in Georgetown. Lydia Tesler died in November 1981, and 9 years later, Otto died unexpectedly. Sandor Tesler's life had been irreparably shattered. His wife and two sons were gone, and all that was left were his three grandchildren, who at the time were living in Spartanburg. An important pursuit that helped Tesler cope with his loneliness and remain active in retirement was his affiliation with Wofford College. He became a student at the college, where he audited more than 50 classes. There he forged a close relationship with students who affectionately called him Papi, Hungarian for grandfather. It became for him a real refuge. At the age of 88, Tesler commented, quote, "I am blessed with Wofford College. Thank God I am able to move and to go 5 times a week to attend classes. I have the great happiness to have wonderful professors who are very nice to me and who appreciate my knowledge of this century, especially in history classes." End quote. Tesler remained engaged with the Spartanburg community as a member of Downtown Rotary, the Spartanburg Area Chamber of Commerce, and a trustee of the Charles Lee Center. In 1997, Wofford College awarded him an honorary Doctor of Humanities, and at the age of 93, the faculty voted to make him a professor of the humanities. After his death at the age of 97, in 2000, Wofford College created the Sandor Tesler Award for Moral Courage and Service to Humankind in his memory, a fitting memorial to a Holocaust survivor whose intelligence, perseverance, righteousness, and kindness made him who he was, a prosperous textile entrepreneur, a loving husband, father, and grandfather, and a pillar of the Southern community that became his home. According to David Tesler, his grandfather was, quote, "the rock of his life, a force of nature." Tesler's obituary remarked that, quote, "his constant example of integrity, industry, and deep concern for human values made him an outstanding and well-loved leader in all endeavors and spurred all those associated with him to strive for excellence in their professional and private lives." Thank you so much. Thank you. Now I would like to continue our celebration of the lives of the Teslers in Spartanburg by inviting Professor Charlie Kay and David Beecham from Wofford to introduce the film that we're going to see. And then I'd like the two of them to kind of talk impromptu about their memories of the Teslers. And I would also invite anyone in the audience who knew them. Unfortunately, I didn't know any of them. All of my information comes from what historians do, research, okay? So I'm sure there are many of you in the audience who can contribute to this discussion as well. Okay, and we'll start this after the introduction.
Thank you, Diane. My name is David Beecham. I am an administrator at Wofford College, and I have been there for a long, 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 long time. And Mr. Tesler was my friend. I go back to the time that shortly after we built the library is when I came to Wofford as a student. And Mr. Tesler was a fixture on the campus for as long as I can remember until he died in 2000. I come this morning to help kick off this video that you're going to see, and it's a talk that was presented by a gentleman who was at that time the president of Wofford, Bernie Dunlap was the president of Wofford from 2000 until 2013, but he joined our faculty in 1993, and after he came to Wofford as to have an endowed professorship in humanities, he started a great fondness and friendship and mentorship relationship with Mr. Tesler, and that they spent days and hours and great times together. We all shared times with Mr. Tesler, but Bernie and Mr. Tesler enjoyed a very, very special and unique friendship. When Bernie was, and I bring greetings from Dr. Dunlap. He lives up in North Carolina, just outside of Tryon, and couldn't be here today. He's traveling, but does send his greetings, and he would want to be a part of anything that celebrated the life of Mr. Tesler. But in the mid-2000s, it might have been 2010, Bernie was invited to give a TED talk, TED, it stands for Technology, Education and Design, and that was a a very prestigious opportunity to give this in a lineup of great speakers that happen in California. Now these TED Talks are happening all over the country. They've kind of blossomed and developed satellite programs around the country. But when Bernie gave this talk, it was a huge deal. And Bernie, it had to be extemporaneous. There could be no notes. I think it was 9 minutes or something like that. And so Bernie has a great reputation as a magnificent speaker and a wonderful spokesperson for just about anything. But he chose Mr. Tesler as the topic of his TED Talk, and it went viral before anybody knew what going viral even meant. And so you'll see, it's one of the most inspirational speeches I think any of us ever had a chance to hear. So, Mark, if you can pull that up.
That's good. Apologize for the secondhand microphone.
Classrooms, right? So let's start by having you tell us how you came to know Sandro Tesler.
Actually, firstly, I would like to say is an apology on behalf of Oakley Coburn. He really wanted to be here. Oakley had met with me a few times and in preparation for this, but he's had a long-term health problem that really flared up very badly this past week. So he's at home in pain and would have loved to have been here. Instead, not here anyway. I came to Walker College in 1986, of course, Opie was already there. I've been calling Opie from the beginning. I tried very hard to call him, Sandro Tesler, that frequently. Opie is, actually he's not Hungarian. Much of his language was English, of course, but also German. He didn't spend as much time in Hungary as many Hungarian people have. His factory was in Čakovec, which is in Croatia. Not too far from Zagreb, about halfway between Zagreb and Budapest. And so he was of Hungarian descent, but always had a difficult issue with Hungarians because of the way that Hungary as a nation had dealt with its anti-Semitism and helped them out of that. But in 1986, I came to Wofford College and began teaching courses in applied ethics, medical ethics and business ethics. On a Tuesday-Thursday schedule. For academics, it's always a question of, you know, what day of the week is it? Monday, Wednesday, Friday class, Tuesday-Thursday class, and that's the way you know what day of the week it is. Now that I'm retired, I have a hard time remembering what day of the week it is, but I believe today is a Sunday. So on Tuesday-Thursdays, I ended up with Opie in my classes in the morning. I taught the same course, two sections, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. He came to the morning one. It was the afternoons, he went out to lunch and all sorts of other things. He came to my class every morning, Tuesday, Thursday. And then he attended other classes, Monday, Wednesday, Friday in the morning, including Ben Dunlap, but history classes and a few others, mixing things up. So that's how I first encountered him. I was told that he was coming to class and a little bit about who he was. I had been there already when he got his honorary doctorate, so I understood that background, but he decided to pick some more classes. He didn't take all, I mean, it's kind of an exaggeration to say he took all the courses in the catalog. He didn't get into the mathematics and the science, and that was a lot of his own engineering background. He really wanted to live his life in the humanities, in the arts, in philosophy, enjoyed those deep thoughts. And as you might given his experience, those thoughts of philosophy deeply troubled him. Why did all this happen? And especially the question he asked a lot now, why does God keep me here? Why am I still here? What does God want from me? All the rest of his family is gone, and here I am up into my 90s, and I'm still here. What is it for? Why am I here? I see a hand from some rude person in the back.
Bob Moss, colleagues of Charlie, we go teach a number of times, but I teach genetics, and he actually attended a genetics class a couple of times when we were talking about eugenics, and he was very helpful talking about some of that background there too. So it's a lot of the classes in things like science and math, you may have gone in a few times.
He just look at it a few times, but yeah. He wouldn't stay for the whole semester with you. Bob and I have talked together many, many times, and we had this thing going on. You're from New York, I'm from North Jersey, and so when we get into it, the students are wondering what language we're speaking.
So I'm wondering how he participated in the classroom. Did he sit and listen, or did he engage? Did he contribute to discussions in class? Especially, of course you teach history, but he had such a personal experience with the Nazis, with the communists. Do you know if he shared those experiences in the classroom?
I'm a philosophy professor, so the history class that I can recall hearing about, Ross Beyer taught a class, and it was specifically brought up there, but I see another hand.
Yes, one of our founders, I was also one of the faculty of Wofford College in the 1980s, and had the honor and privilege of having this continuum as an auditor in numerous classes, especially my class in the philosophy of art. Now, what was wonderful was that when I would talk about early 20th century music or art or philosophy in its historical context, couldn't keep his hand down. He, as a matter of fact, had heard the debut performances of some of Bartok's compositions that I was referencing in my lectures. He was a very, very active participant, and what he did for my students was to personalize the experience. We brought it down from the clouds to earth through the medium of Mr. Tesler's memory and his experiences. He was living memory. He remembered World War I, though he was a boy when it erupted. He remembered the Russian Revolution just a few hundred miles from where he was living. He remembered the Russian Civil War, and of course he remembered the Nazis and the Holocaust. He was living memory, not only embodying this for himself and those who immediately knew him, but for all the students in the classroom with him. What he did for my students, in addition to making these kinds of explicit verbal contributions, was to model to them what it means to be a lifelong learner. Most of my students were 20 or 21, he was 86 and up. So this was part of the lesson of having had Mr. Tesler ordered my philosophy classes, especially the ones that I taught in the philosophy of art, which was a lifelong passion.
Wonderful, thank you.
He was always an inspiration to the students because of what he had done. He's modeling this. But in my business ethics class, it was especially advantageous since it was very clear that he was a successful businessman. If, as a philosophy professor, you try to talk to the students about business and they say, well, if you were so smart about business, you'd be out there making money. He was a man who had actually done this and understood what I was talking about because he had lived it. And so when he talked about the way he treated his workers as family, these are not just a resource. I'm not creating jobs for them. They are creating the business with me. We're in this together. And that's frankly what had saved his life. I mean, the way he treated his workers as family, so that when, as you mentioned before, the Nazis begin to take over and say, we're getting all the Jews out of the town and we're going to take over the factory. No, we cannot run this factory without the leadership of Sandor Perez. We don't need him. Yes, we do. Well, tomorrow get me the signatures of over 1,000 workers, and then he can stay. They got 1,400 signatures the next day. 1,400 people who worked in the factory are willing to put their names on the line to save him. This is the kind of relationship he had with his employees, because they knew who he was and they knew that he cared about them. A wise man. One of the little things I think about that TED talk, there are wonderful myths out there, and mythology is great, and Spielberg moments are wonderful. A little over the top, but this one has done that, relates again, it's just without notes. But there was a fellow who was stealing from him, and it's in the memoir, and you can access the memoir, it's on the Wofford website from the library. The easiest way to find out more about Opie is to look at the Wikipedia page for Sandor Kessler. It's all in there, and lots of good links. But there was a fellow who was caught stealing, but it wasn't shoveling into a truck. It was a little bit. He was caught sneaking out with some stockings. And so he's brought in to meet the boss, expecting to be fired. And as I heard it from Opie, he says, he's coming in, and what he said to him was, I don't know why you would steal this from me. You can get these from me at cost any time. But you stole these. Apparently, you thought you really needed these. I don't know whether it's for your wife, or your girlfriend, or whatever, but you thought you really needed it enough that you stole it. So you keep these stockings, but don't ever do this again. So that's the wisdom he had there. He wasn't letting this thief with a truckload get away with things. And it wasn't much later, but it was almost in that same season, when the German sympathizers, because this fellow was one of the German sympathizers, and the Germans came in and their people started to tear into the houses of the Jews in Chakovets and create all kinds of damage and destruction and vandalism. This fellow was at Sandor's door to protect his house. Okay, so the response that way. The fellow who told him later about not taking the cyanide, that's a whole other story, which, and there are only two stories here. I mean, it's a double Spielberg moment. Things pop back to him all the time. And that, in fact, is like gravity. The closing line to his memoirs. He talks about all the awful things he had happen to him throughout the years. He says here, this is the last paragraph, he says here it becomes especially difficult to explain my life. How could a crippled man be successful in his life, and how could his family, and who could save his family during the terrible Holocaust? We were only four people in our town who were not deported. And a little bit further, the people who worked for me in the big plant which I and my brother had built toward the end, that my father and that feeling of loyalty I had from them I've been able to create all my life. I do not know why this is so, but in spite of all the tragedy in my life, I do know that whatever kindness I have shown to others has been returned to me. Almost any time that we went out to dinner, someone would come up to him and say, thank you. Thank you so much for what you did. Thank you for what you did for my mother, for my father. And very often, when he said gracious things back, and they left, he would lean over to me and say, I don't remember who that was. But he did all these things, and he didn't do them in order to be known to do them. He did them because it was something to be done.
Yes?
Is there any way that you can not leave us with the cliffhanger? Where you said he shared with you, what did God want from me?
Yes.
Why am I still here? You don't have to be 90 to ask that question.
Right. Exactly. And
did he share with you his conclusion?
He did not have a conclusion. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that anybody else does. It's a good question to ask, as you suggest. We all should ask that and keep asking. It's a very good question.
Yes, he needs to verbalize that conclusion. He lived it.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're testifying to that right here.
But it wasn't a self-awareness. It wasn't like I'm doing it. It was, you know, in that search, he embodied it. Yes, yeah.
Not to take away from Mr. Tesler, because he was a very learned and good man. He became, he and his wife became good friends with my parents. My parents moved here in 1943. They were Holocaust survivors. My father lost his family in concentration camp. And similar stories how my father got out of concentration camp. So they had a lot in common. Besides my father being very into classical music, playing the flute, the oboe, the English horn, the piccolo, the orchard.
And I said, can everyone hear her?
No.
Okay, hold that. Let's do this. Let's bring this out as far as it can go. That way, everybody, I'm not sure where they are.
This is Mary.
Hi. My name is Marion Cohen, and I grew up in Spartanburg. My parents were here from 1943. They were Holocaust survivors. When Mr. and Mrs. Tesler moved to Spartanburg, my parents became friends with them because they had so much in common. My grandparents perished in the Holocaust. My father escaped concentration camp through my mother's parents that paid his way out through a similar experience with a factory and a man that stole from my grandfather. And they also had in common classical music. My father was a pianist, played the organ, the oboe, the flute, and piccolo. So they had a lot in common and a lot of days were spent together.
So, did you know him?
I had met him on occasion.
Okay.
I moved away from Spartanburg when I went to college in 1960, so,
okay.
You know, just brief memories.
Okay, thank you very much for that.
Yes. I'm wondering what happened to Andrew Tesler's kids. We lived in the same neighborhood. I babysat when my brother and I worked at Butte Knit in the lab. So he did get jobs to the local.
As a high school student.
As high school.
Yes, we all were.
You did.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we must have, right? Oh my gosh.
I'm one of them that was playing also. There's about 15 or 20 of us.
Yeah.
And kids in high school said, I guess your guys can give you a job. For your people, that's the way they used to describe it. But a whole lot of us worked with those plants. It was very generous.
Yeah. So I'm just wondering where, what happened to his, Andrew's wife. I knew them better than Samuel.
I think there's a couple people.
And we were in a community pool. And, you know, they were the kids and, you know.
Right. There are a couple people here that can help answer the question. I grew up here in Spartanburg. I knew not this Marion Jasmine because our parents were also friends. Polly and Mary Yogan were very close to the children. I'm Shelley Yogan Whitesburg. I grew up here. I was a cheerleader. I can talk about it. You hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I don't have as much of a story. I've tried to learn more of the history of the family because I knew Opie as like my grandparents were gone. And Robin and I, his daughter, Andrew's daughter, were the same age. Granddaughter, Andrew's daughter is Robin, Sandor's granddaughter. She had two brothers, David and Tommy. I don't know the details, but there were two boys. I only know two boys, Robin's brothers. Those are the only two that I knew growing up here.
And Tracy.
I didn't know Tracy then. But I know that Tommy has passed. He was the younger of the boys, and is no longer with us. I actually was talking to Robin and was hopeful that she would come and join us. She wasn't able. But again, as a child, I think I don't have any friends. I had a bar. My sister's friends here today.
because at my age, there were, I think, three or four of us that were Jewish, and they came to Sunday school and Hebrew school some of the time.
Okay.
But anyway, she just learned. My mom was friends with Jane, Andrew's wife. They went to the YMCA together. I had lots of spend the nights and lots of parties at Robin's house. I remember the parents, and again, didn't realize that Andrew had passed so young, you know, and how young the kids were, two of us,
right.
And again, everything that was said about Opie, he was a one who wanted to know him, and what he did for the South, and I just wish our world today had a lot more Opies.
Sure. Thank you. Joe, would you want to?
Yes, I think it's in Atlanta.
Do we know where they
would
do
that?
Actually,
Robin is local.
Robin's local. And I do have David's contact information because I've spoken with him.
So one of the children still lives here?
Robin.
Yeah, the daughter is still
here. Yes. Right. Robin's here. I spoke to David, and he just, you know, lights up because he was the most important person in David's life, Sandor, because his father died so young.
I had heard that the Teslers, I had thought it was Shonda, had given Wofford a large collection of artwork. Could anybody talk to that?
Yes.
Yeah, Oakley Coburn would have been the person who would best address that, but he had a wonderful collection of Eastern European paintings from about a century ago, and he had those in his home. And at one point offered to exhibit them at the college, and they've eventually been donated to the school. If you go again to the Wikipedia page, there's a link there to that art collection. You saw the one portrait of him here, but on that same page are these others. It was actually that collection and its presence at the college that brought in Mr. Robicek, who called Oakley Coburn, who was dean of the library and in charge of his collections at that time. He said, I hear you have some Eastern European paintings. I have some too. Would you like me to send you one? And so that connection began there. So there's a nice collection, growing collection of art at the college now, but that was the beginning of the whole collection, actually, but especially the core of that Eastern European collection, which is not always on exhibit. It's in various places. In fact, just recently when I retired, I was at the provost house and I saw some of those paintings on the wall of the provost house, which kind of startled me because the last time I'd seen them, they had been on the wall in Obie's house, and they don't belong here anymore.
How did he get them out of Europe?
He was able to sneak some of them out when he left. They had to be prepared a bit because he rolled them up in the luggage and lay. I mean, if you're leaving the country, you don't want to carry big boxes with frames and the whole thing. So they were rolled or folded, and that was the core of his collection, he himself. And then when he was in New York, he also purchased some from others who had come over and brought these things with them to enable themselves to start in the new world. And so he bought from them, and they had the cash then instead of the painting. So that's how he began to build his collection.
How many languages did Sandor Tesler speak, and what did he speak in Croatian? What do you speak in Croatian?
I don't know, but he was English, of course, Hungarian, German. He actually taught a course in German at the college. There was a deficit of German professors at the higher level, so the higher level students went to his house and learned German. So he actually did teach a course once, but otherwise he was not a teaching professor in that sense that he had courses, but always gave us wisdom because of his presence there.
Did he speak Yiddish?
I don't know. No, I didn't
hear him. He spoke German, not Yiddish.
Now
Gary and Jews mostly spoke German.
Yes.
And that's where Obi comes from, Oba. It's not really a Hungarian root, but a German root.
Yes. I just want to add something about the tree, the seed not falling apart from the tree, with Andy, with being much like his father, when they, I was groundbreaking up a few things, back when it occurred, and a lot of elected representatives were invited to that groundbreaking, but the mayor of Spartanburg, no elected official from Spartanburg County attended, and no elected official attended except Fritz Hollands. And the reason for that is that he announced that it would be a union shop that opened, God forbid, and it did, and we're all better off.
Unions were not big in Spartanburg.
Now, the portrait that was on the screen here before, that is hanging in the main lobby of the Walker Library. So if you ever want to see that, that's a permanent exhibit there. And you couldn't see much of that through this, but if you actually get up close and look into his eyes, you get to see what kind of a wonderful, charming person he was. And that little twinkle, the sense of humor, really, really amazing. But as I said, it was a wonderful addition to have in classes because he had that history, even for business ethics classes. I mean, here he is, he's talking about his own experiences. And because he took the same class over and over again, we changed cases and so he was able to keep going. But he would get the same classes. That's, I enjoy teaching medical ethics and business ethics because that could change the material every time, deal with different cases. And he would raise his hand at a certain point and knew pretty much at this point what he was going to say. I don't understand, he was saying. Back in the 1930s, in Yugoslavia, a poor country, we had health care for our workers. Why don't we? And things like that would make an impact on the students because they knew that he was a successful business. Three times over, he built his fortune. It was first taken away from the Nazis, then it was taken away by the communists, and then he did it again a third time here. And a man like that must know what he's talking about. It's not always easy to understand, but his manner of speech and his accent, I guess somewhere between the Divorce Sisters and the Count on Sesame Street. but with a little bit of a rap, you can even understand what he's saying.
Yes. Did he ever share with you on a personal level if he had any regrets in his life? And do you know if he ever had a relationship with Israel or went to Israel?
Never went to Israel, as far as I know. Didn't really have any interest in that sort of a movement, I think. He wasn't Orthodox in any sense. He was kosher. One time we met to a concert and Bergard stopped at a restaurant. And I have to say, I've never seen anybody dispatch a whole lobster as quickly as he did. Maybe he was 90 years old. He said when he was young, his father had said to him, says, don't worry about what the rabbi says. Says, first, listen to what he knows. And that's the way he lived. What did you guess?
Do you know if he knew Max Heller or had any relationship with him?
I never heard him mention it.
I was just going to add, that was so beautiful what you said as far as, I don't know if I don't listen to the rabbi says what he knows. But from his heart, that was so him. And as you were talking, I was thinking, those of us that did grow up here, I've been in Tucson, Arizona for 38 years, and Rabbi Salver, Rabbi Max, is still my most favorite rabbi of all. And I believe Mr. Tesler Sander, they gave that same warmth. You know, I think of someone that wise, that well-traveled, they would come through so much pain and loss, and be so angry and cold. You know, anger, I can't think of it. And to be so loving and warm and help everyone just, again, it is the same kind of warmth that I felt as I was a child sitting here too, so. We gotta listen to our rabbi some, but I do believe coming from the heart is exactly what he taught.
And it's hard to convey to students historical perspective, the age, and what he went through, but he was there, and so he could say things that I kind of shock them at times. I mean, in business ethics class, I show a little clip from Charlie Chaplin, Modern Times, 1930. And he would say, I remember when that movie came out, you know, and the students are kind of like, well, you know, here is that whole century presented and it's embodied in the classroom, and they understand what that passage of time means, because in their young lives, 17, 18, 19 years, what's that?
Absolutely.
An academic question. Did his presence in your classrooms inhibit the other students' participation? Because I can imagine, you know, raising your hand to ask a question of the professor in Sandor's presence, that could be a little inhibitory. What was your experience there?
I never noticed that. It wasn't, I mean, I don't know exactly why it would have inhibited them, because it wasn't as if he would have been critical of anything that they said. He was very helpful for me. Didn't inhibit what I said either, because I knew that I could get backed up in a variety of ways. Once in a while, he asked a question or said something that they didn't actually understand because of his accent, and so when I was responding to it, I would try to rephrase it so that I would be clear what the question was, just like we just did a moment ago before the microphone was handed out. Yeah. But no, it didn't inhibit them in any way. They did respond to him, though. I was very stubborn throughout my years about students wearing hats in class. And I'd say, this is a classroom in a college. You're here to learn. It's kind of dropped off. Don't wear your baseball cap in class. You come in, show some respect for the place, get your hats off. So they did that. One time, Opie and I were walking into a restaurant, one of the restaurants in town here, and there's a group of students there. Who were Wofford guys, fraternity group or whatever else, they all got their baseball caps on the way they do. And one looked up and saw him come through the door and knocked the hats off. And he was very impressed by that.
Joe had something to carry.
Okay, can we address Marcus for a second about inhibited students? One of the people that was going to come here this weekend to Pitt Bank, it was the attorney in Myrtle Beach, and then Tommy Britton. Some of the attorneys here may know him. A very, very successful trial attorney, graduated from Wofford in the 1970s. He later became chairman of the board of trustees at Wofford for several years. He took classes with Sean Gore Tesler, and he said he made everything real instead of esoteric or, you know, he just made it real and inspired everybody. He was, like I said, he was open to everybody. He was somebody you could sit down and just talk to. And everybody was absolutely adoring him. They feel like it makes life, everybody's life richer in any way. And it was a great experience to this day. He says it's one of the best experiences he ever had. And he was going to come this weekend. We had another engagement he had to go to at the last minute. He didn't come, otherwise, he'd rather stand up and make a speech. He's very good at it, too. But he was really great at the students.
Carrie?
I was wondering, in his time here during the 60s, what was the way that he navigated when civil rights movement was up? Obviously, he integrated, but just in the larger society, when he went to school, rather than the Soviet.
The best of my knowledge, he was not engaged in that politically at all. But simply in terms of what he and his family did. When Andrew came down, there was a factory already in existence. But when Sandro came down, he saw the plans for the factory and double water fountains and double facilities, and he said, no, we're not going to do that here. And that startled people, but he made it work. He made it work because he was politically shrewd, socially shrewd, and he knew that the people in Kings Mountain needed this. And they would have to put up with it. When he and his wife first came into the city, they came down on a train. And they got out at the train station, and they saw right away, here's the signs, they're white and colored. And she looked at him, he looked at her, and they went and sat in the color section. But this is what they did from the beginning. It's not that he was engaged politically in any way. but just the way he lived his life, and because of the force of the business, he could accomplish great things. And I don't think he was self-conscious. In the quotation, he thinks he was probably the first in the Carolina, maybe the first in the South to integrate a factory. But that's not why he did it. He did it because it was the right thing to do.
Right. There are a couple.
I have a pleasure of knowing both of them.
I grew up in Spartanburg, and I had the pleasure of knowing both of them. We all know what wonderful businessmen and industrialists they were. I had the pleasure of working at Dudenett Mills for 4 summers when I was a student at Wofford, and both Andrew and Sandor, I was in the shipping department. They didn't hesitate to come in and help pull an order, and they were so well respected in the plant. But they were also such, you know, personable, friendly people. I went boating with Andrew on Lake Lure several times, and my dad, may rest in peace, and Sandor, they had a weekly card game, a tournament card game, I think it was called Scott or Scout or something. So they socialized a good bit. They liked to eat and drink and socialize when they were playing this card game. But they were just, you know, more than business people. They were so friendly, personable, and you know, it was a pleasure knowing both of you.
And let's one or two more, and then we're going to need to wrap it up.
I taught philosophy and religion at Montclair State University in Northern New Jersey for 42 years. And I write on the relationship between Judaism and Christianity. And I'm very impressed by what the speaker on the film said, that Mr. Tesla said to him, but basically people are good. That's in the Diary of Anne Frank. Describe everything. I believe that people are basically good at heart. And that seems to me the difference between Judaism and Pauline Christianity. In Christianity, as outlined by Paul, we are evil but redeemed. In Judaism, we are good but flawed. And that is a base, that is to me the difference. Not who was Jesus. Because only if you have the burden of a basically sinful nature do you need a heavenly Savior to come and do for you what you can't do for yourself. Be a second Adam and redeem the sin of Adam. If Judaism doesn't believe we inherit the sin of Adam, that we start with a clean slate, and basically, therefore, we are without evil when we're born, but we are flawed, we trip and fall, but then we get up. But basically, even after the Holocaust, incredibly, Judaism continues to teach that people are basically good, and it's the flaws we have to deal with. And I think, despite my love of Christianity, that's why I remain a Jew.
Thank you for that. That was Lily, just let's finish with Lily.
If I could come in. Okay, go ahead. One of the books that Hope you really loved is Simon Wiesenthal's The Sunflower, which tells a great tragic story, but then raises the question at the end, which is related to what you just said to me. Here is this awful thing that's happened. Now, how do I engage with that, and can I forgive? And is it my place to forgive someone for what they've done to someone else? And this is a constant theme in Opie's life. He's seen all this happen. How does he connect with this? That question again, what does God want from him? But he used to hand these out like candy. He would bring copies, and a couple of times we actually used it in class. Basic question, after all these terrible things have done, now we have a German soldier who's killed lots of people, asking for forgiveness from a random prisoner, just because he's Jewish. What's my role here? Should I forgive him or not? Wiesenthal asked the question, and then at the end, there are the opinions of a few dozen different people of various backgrounds from around the world, famous people, and just engaging that question. Constant puzzle for him. Mentioned one other book, which he also loved, Appelfeld. He just loved Appelfeld. He thought that he should have won the Nobel Prize. Badenheim 1939 says this captures our situation. We just could not have imagined. We, as he said, we were living in a dream world. We couldn't imagine that this is what was happening. And that's why even though he and his brother Joseph had an opportunity to leave for America before the Nazis came to the town, they didn't take it. They didn't really see that this is something that grand, that horrible could actually have happened. And so they stayed and got caught up in the middle of it. So these are two books that he was pushing.
Could you say the name and author of that one again?
This one? This is Aaron Appelfeld. It's translated into English and written in Hebrew. Badenheim, 1939. And the other one is The Sunflower by Simon Mason.
Okay, let's finish up with Lilith.
To your knowledge, did he encounter any anti-Semitism in the years that you knew or that he shared with you?
In the early years, as was mentioned before, when they were setting up their business, there were some concerns mistreatment. He never took offense. He never took it to heart. He didn't hold a grudge. He didn't tell stories. So it was happening, and I've known from other sources, those sorts of, especially with Andrew's ascendancy. Here's this guy comes into town. You know, not only is there Jews, but they're Yankees, they're foreigners, whatever, and they think they're good. But then when he treated his workers so well, when he took everyone in as family, the workers themselves were able that way to feel for him. And so when that sort of thing appeared, he had lots of friends. He had people to not just protect him physically, but share the news that these are good people, even if they're not like us. And so that's what I think helped him most. Not that he's here fighting anti-Semitism, but he's here with other people. People who are part of my family, part of the human family, part of my business, people who are helping me succeed in business just as I'm helping them. And because he could treat them as family, they treated him as family, regardless of where he came from. So I think that's the blessing, that's the way he ended it.
Thank you so much for inviting
me. Just to echo that, please join me again in thanking Dr. Vecchio, Dr. K. And thanks to all of you for joining us this weekend. We certainly hope that you'll join us again in Columbia, May 2nd through 3rd. Find more information about those meetings on our website, jhssc.org, and please do consider joining us as a member. Thank you.